It is written, I am the Aleph and the Tav, the beginning and the ending, says Yahweh Elohim, which is and which was and which is to come, Yahweh Tzevaot. Welcome to Radio Free Alaska. You're joining us today on the 6th day of February 2023. And today we're going to be discussing morals and ethics as we broadcast freedom in an unfree world from the undisclosed location in an undisclosed place, broadcasting from the towers of Radio Free Alaska. So we begin with defining our terms, something very important in any discussion begins with the notion that words have meaning and that they mean what they mean and they don't mean what they don't mean. This is the fundamental concept of epistemology, that all intellectual understanding inside the human mind centers around the issue of language, and knowledge cannot be had and understanding cannot be reckoned unless it is realized that a word has a particular meaning and doesn't mean something else, that things have a particular identity in existence as what they are, and equally true, that they are not what they are not. Sounds simplistic, sounds obvious, but critical to the idea of obtaining knowledge, wisdom, and understanding. So we start with this idea of the word more. More. Well, what is a more? A more is the essential or characteristic custom and convention of a community. An easier way to understand that is a more is what people do. It's what people do. It's not what people intend to do, but it's actually what people do. Sometimes we're surprised by what we do. You know, some people have these Fitbits that they carry around with them. And at the end of the day, they're shocked to learn that they've walked 8 miles during the day. Who knew? Other people have other things that they do that are a real surprise. When people start keeping a budget to determine that they're spending more money on coffee at the espresso shack than they're spending on gasoline for their car, all reckoned by taking a closer look at the things you do, not necessarily the things you intend to do. Now, morality is the condition of the customs and conventions of a community. Again, the scripture says, "You shall know them by their fruit." What is their fruit? Their fruit is the things that they do. This is the mores of the community. You shall know the righteousness of people, not by the things they intend to do, but by the things they actually do. And so when you walk through the orchard, the tree might tell you to itself, "I'm an olive tree," but when you look at the fruit, you find dates, or you find figs, but you don't find olives. The tree may try to tell you, "I am a righteous tree growing in good soil," but the fruit of the tree is a poisonous grape, or a poisonous berry, or a poisonous mushroom. You see, you can know the tree by its fruit. And when we talk about a tree, let's talk about the tree as it describes metaphorically the nation or the culture. We can know the culture and we can know the nation by its fruit. So when we look at something like downtown Portland, Oregon, which is now completely encamped with thousands, even tens of thousands of homeless people living in tents, living with what little they have in a shopping cart, surrounded by filth. There is no consideration of where should we put the trash and where does the recycling go. The trash and the recycling end up on the street along with everything else. There is no regular use of a bathroom. Instead, people are using the street. And so in addition to tens of thousands of homeless, there's also thousands of people hopelessly addicted to fentanyl products, meth, and so forth. And the city freely gives them needles to continue their habit. So as a consequence, it's not uncommon to meet many people who are hopelessly drug addicted, people who are suffering from acute psychopathies, such as schizophrenia, on the street at other psychosis, to be attacked on the street, to be mugged on the street, to even meet people that you might describe as zombies, irrational people, out of their mind, doing things, talking to themselves and attacking you. Now, not all homeless are in this situation. Many homeless have fallen through the cracks in a society that cares less for the people it governs, cares less for the people it governs. Instead, it makes money on the homeless, pocketing cash in their own pockets, pretending to take care of these people who are in critical need, while allowing the banks to inflate the value of real estate until the homeless ranks increase and increase and increase. So what do we see now in Portland? We see a model for the rest of the nation as to what no one would want to be. What is the fruit of the tree of the practice of progressive liberalism as expressed in the woke minds of Oregonians? A burned out hulk of a downtown, infested with human life at its lowest possible level. Beneath the expectation even of 15th century living in Britain, we've arrived at a level of decadence that precedes all industrial aspects of civilization. But this is the desired outcome of the woke agenda, who cannot see the fruit of the tree. They can't see the fruit. In their minds, they intend to be an ethical and upstanding civilization. But the fruit, the more, the morality that's expressed on the street is decadent, defiled, decaying, disrupted, destructive, and is going to come to an abject failure at the end of the day. So mores are what we do. Now, let me give you another example of a more. Of course, you know, when we look at the UK has cameras everywhere. But in those places where there are no cameras on the roadways, people do not drive the posted speed limit. They drive at the rate of speed they so desire. When they know cameras are present, they adhere to the camera code because the speeding ticket is automatic. But in the States, we don't have this kind of enforcement. And as a result, you may have a speed limit posted at 65, but the average rate of speed will be 68 or will be 70 or even 72, depending on where you drive, depending on the conditions. Few people actually drive the speed limit. So the more, the morality, is how people actually drive. The ethic is the posted speed limit, because the ethic is what you are supposed to do. Now let's talk about the definition of ethics. Ethics, the science of right conduct and character, treats the nature or the grounds of a moral obligation and the rules which ought to determine conduct in accordance with this obligation, the doctrine of man's duty in respect to himself and the rights of others. So we see that ethics impose a moral obligation or impose a moral rule or they impose a moral standard. Now, you may say to yourself, well, I'm not under the law, but you most assuredly are on a bowling alley lane that has gutters to the left and gutters to the right. And these gutters are created by an ethical understanding. It's ethical to have a bowling lane that's exactly 8 feet wide and not a foot wider. And to enforce this bowling lane, we're going to put gutters to the left and gutters to the right. These are boundaries beyond which you cannot go. And you might say to yourself, well, I can go beyond those boundaries. But if you do, in America, we have the largest prison population on earth for those who have insisted upon walking in the gutters instead of on lane. So there is ethics being imposed upon you, whether you wish it or not. So there is a morality, there is a moral code there that has been derived from an ethical understanding. And our duty as people in the free world is to question the underlying source of the ethical standard to see if it lives up to a code of righteousness. This becomes very, very important, especially when you're talking about natural jurisprudence, the particular system of principles and rules concerning moral obligations and regard to the rights of others. Okay, so let's talk about some ethical understanding. When we talk about ethical understanding, a primary ethic that comes out, you hear it quite often among freedom-loving people, is do whatever you want as long as you don't hurt someone else. I always found that standard to be ambiguous, nebulous, and subjective. Well, I'm not hurting you. I mean, I have people ask me the question, why do you oppose same-sex marriage when our marriage isn't hurting your marriage at all? So why would you oppose it? Now we see, of course, that the practice of same-sex marriage has an acute cost to the social order, demoralizing the social order, de-energizing the social order, bringing the social order to a stasis of inertness, where people really don't care to do much of anything anymore. Now, this is empirically demonstrated and proven in the text Sex and Culture by J.D. Unwin, published in 1934, where he demonstrates that a society that abandons the ethos associated with monogamy and the protection of that marriage, coming into the marriage and remaining in that marriage, is the society that is the most energized, the society that is the most disciplined, the society that rises quickly to a position of success and authority, as compared to the society that says, we will abandon the discipline of one man, one woman marriage, and we will embrace multiplicitous sexual orientations. And in doing so, without drawing the question, first of all, how many sexual orientations do you intend to admit as legitimate practices of human behavior in your culture? That's one question. But without addressing that question, we can look at the empirical data and see how quickly the Western world is collapsing into third world status. In particular, those jurisdictions which were the very first to rush to the embrace of same-sex marriages are the very cities where the homeless encampments are overwhelming the downtowns, where the downtowns are no longer places for pedestrians to be, where the economy is falling apart, where tens of thousands of layoffs are going on right now, where industries have fled, corporations have fled, employers have fled, because the entire living environment is no longer civilized. It's defiled. It's destroyed. It's decayed. It's denaturalized and it's demoralized. So let's talk a little bit about the ethic that drove us to this demoralization. We have one ethical code that says people who can grant consent have the right to any sexual preference they want. Well, sexual preference isn't really the issue. The codification of the sexual preference as a matter of societal organization is the question. So when we say, well, we're going to open the door to sexual orientation, when we open the door to that sexual orientation, what orientation are you willing to accept? For instance, you say, well, it's a perfectly legitimate for consenting adults to be engaged in same-sex relationships. Well, if you were in a finite and small society whose fundamental goal was to populate your area so that you might be able to move out of a wilderness setting into a jointly managed civilization, you might take umbrage with the idea that not two people, but four people are going to be removed from the proliferation of mankind in your wilderness. That is to say, two families would not exist because two men elected to join with one another rather than with two other women. Those two other women would remain unmarried or be able to find a spouse in a small and finite world. And you used to hear this routine. This is a routine complaint, by the way, in the 80s and 90s, that single women were forever looking for a great guy and they'd meet some guy. And, oh, well, he's a homosexual, so I can't go out with him anymore. That we ruled him out. Well, when you look at this idea, and this is not to condemn anybody, but this is just to say, look at the natural effect that happens. And ultimately, it has a societal effect. But the ethos is the liberty, the sexual license to do what thou wilt is a preferred position over than the discipline to maintain and practice chastity before marriage and monogamy thereafter. If this is the value, chastity before marriage and monogamy thereafter, what can we expect from a society? Well, as difficult as it may be, and as hard to understand as young people may have, in recognizing that this is preferred value, and as much as the flesh desires fornication and is restricted from doing so, nonetheless, that border, those gutters on the bowling lane, narrow the bowling lane. And they narrow the bowling lane pretty substantially. Now, who are the bowlers bowling on that bowling lane? Well, you can see this. Let me give you an example. When we compared the snooker table in Britain to the pool table in the States. When you play pool in the States, it's one kind of art form. Why? Because the pockets are wider than the pockets on a snooker table, and they have beveled corners that are forgiving of a wayward shot. So a wayward shot, slightly off the mark, still has the opportunity to go in the pocket. But on a snooker table, this is not the case. There is no beveled corner. The ball is either directly on target and goes into the pocket as designed. But if it's off even to the slightest degree, it's not going in. It bounces and comes back out. So when you take an accomplished snooker player and you remove him off the snooker table and you take him to play on a pool table in the States, who do you think has the more acute skill at shooting the ball? It's going to be the snooker player. And it's the same thing you find in a society that has a narrow bowling lane. Now, our bowling lane's only 4 feet wide, but we learned how to get strikes on that bowling lane because we disciplined ourselves on the narrow path of righteousness. Compare that to the bowling alley that says, well, we want to have a license for all kinds of sexual orientation. So we moved the bowling alley out to a 20-foot wide pathway. The pins are still set up in the same size that they used to be, but now there's a 20-foot wide bowling alley, and it's got gutters up at the edge. So what do you think the skill set is going to be of those people that are bowling on that alley? Well, the truth is, and this is the expense of same-sex marriage, people quit playing altogether, right? They quit playing altogether. They don't develop any skill. They become inert, inactive. And the society degrades into collapse. That's what happens. So what was the expense of licensing same-sex marriage? Well, ultimately, it was a defilement and a degradation that has worked to completely destroy society. And if you want to see the fruit of that tree, walk the streets of downtown Portland. Walk the streets of downtown San Francisco. Walk the streets of downtown Seattle, and you'll see the fruit of that. Now, let's talk about this continued expose. Well, if two consenting adults say yes, then it's okay. Okay. What about three consenting adults? Is that okay? If consent is the issue, then of course, polygamy is a sexual orientation that has to be respected by law. All right. So bigamy, polygamy, polyamory, all of this is going to be accepted. What about marriage between a human being and an animal? Many states, believe it or not, decriminalized bestiality after same-sex marriage was approved. Why not? If Oklahoma ruled at one point that if a person doesn't say no, then they've said yes. Implied consent. And if an animal is incapable of saying no, then an animal has said yes. If a building is incapable of saying no, then the building has said yes. If a computer is incapable of saying no, then the computer says yes. There are people that want to marry their computer. There have been people who've tried to marry buildings, then people who have tried to marry animals. This is just a fact. I mean, it's just a fact. All right, but let's talk about some of the more difficult sexual orientation. What if you have somebody who is a rapist and he says, oh, rape is my sexual orientation? Is that a sexual orientation that is protected by law? All right. And then, of course, we get to pedophilia and the issue of consent. And the state has worked continually to deprive the parent from being the consenting agent for the child. For instance, in states, many of the states, the parent cannot consent or withhold consent to a pregnant daughter wanting an abortion. In fact, the school system begins to teach the girls in the public schools in the states in the fifth grade, if you get pregnant, you can go down to the nurse and the nurse will take you over to get an abortion without your parents' knowledge or consent, because they have no right to consent or to have any knowledge about whether or not their prospective grandchild is going to be born. Now, many of the school districts have adopted rules concerning vaccines. You don't have the right to consent or not consent as to whether your child gets a vaccine, and the child can be vaccinated at school without the parents' consent or even knowledge. Well, then you get to pedophilia. Who is the parent to consent whether or not a child wants to be in a love relationship with an elder? You see, now pedophilia is now being called a sexual orientation, as is transgenderism a sexual orientation that society must accommodate. Well, what is the cost of this accommodation? What is the ethic behind this concept? The ethic is clearly and obviously not scripturally based. The ethic is premised upon some other idea, some other ideology, some other conceiving agent. And who is this conceiving agent? Who is this conceiving agent that has decided that the righteousness penned in Scripture is no longer relevant or the standard by which an ethic is developed, but rather we're going to develop the ethic premised upon some other standard? Well, what is that other standard and who wrote it? What is its source? Do what thou wilt. What is its source? Well, when we look clearly at it, we can see that the concept of the secular state and the secular state rising over the world to say secularism is our God, democracy is our God, and human passion and its desire and carnality is our king. So as a result, we have this lifelong pursuit that is dictated by those who are without a born soul, saying the law should be set up to satisfy my carnality and not your rationalism. And since we don't care about cause and effect, we will suppress all information that establishes the empirical data saying that our ethic is wrong, because easily established. You can see the death rate go up. You can see the suicide rate go up. You can see marriage plummet to the floor. You can see the divorce rate go up. You can see children committing suicide now. The number one cause of death in young people under the age of 40, both male and female, is suicide. Why would that be? Because there is no family, because the family's been destroyed, because there is no dad, because there is no mom. This kind of data is suppressed and repressed. So we're going to be taking a look more at these ideas and seeing what the ethic should be as we continue in Radio Free Alaska this week. Stay with us, if you will. Join us at Sefer Publishing Group, sefer.net. And also, you can join us at Sefer Academy for further instruction, sefacademy.net. I want to thank you for being here, and we shall see you tomorrow on Radio Free Alaska, the voice of freedom in an unfree world.